ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Wednesday, the 28th of May. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, he said he'd end the war in one day. President Trump now frustrated at Russia's path to peace. And in times of trouble, you know the SES, maybe even the ADF. Now, meet DRA, the veteran volunteers, rolling up their sleeves.
Even things that might not seem that important but are in the big scheme of things. So a wide range of roles that we can take on, and a lot of them are based on the experience of our veterans and former and current first responders.
More than 6,000 people are helping with the flood recovery in the New South Wales mid-north as the cleanup blitz continues. Authorities are continuing to assess flooded properties on the mid-north coast and the Hunter, and more than 10,000 cubic metres of debris has been removed so far. Reporter Alison Shaw is in Wingham. She joined me earlier. Alison, what are you seeing there in Wingham as the cleanup continues?
Andy, the people here are definitely feeling shell-shocked. A week on, they're still in disbelief that this has all happened and they've got such a long process of recovery here. The town's about a 15-minute drive away from Taree, and it was hit hard by these floods, especially those living near the Manning River and Cedar Party Creek. I met one man, Chris Smith, who's a veteran. He and his wife were sitting on the lawn outside their house on camp chairs, having their morning coffee next to their caravan, which they told me they borrowed from a friend and have been living in. They were some of the many who've lost everything, and when I walked through their house, they're still cleaning out a lot of stuff that had been damaged, trying to salvage some pantry items and items from Chris's wife's craft room. She's a dressmaker, and there's muddy footprints through the house, and furniture and appliances have been ripped out. There's still some photographs of their granddaughters hanging that are askew. Chris is someone who feels like he's been left behind, and he says he's feeling really frustrated by the lack of support. He tried to go to the recovery centre in Taree yesterday, and he said he waited for hours and talked to someone about getting power back on, but he didn't feel like it made any difference. This is a bit of what he had to say.
We've lost everything, like just totally gone. Couldn't get insurance because they wouldn't look at us. It was $40,000 for it. You know, I'm on a veteran's pension. I'm a veteran after 22 years in Defence Force. And look, I've been through 7 cyclones in my life, and this was the scariest I've ever been in. I don't know where we're going to go from here, you know, like, we're going to try and struggle to get all this stuff out, and we can't lift it, we can't do anything. All we can do is just slowly throw it out the front, and hope for the best. There's no one here helping us. This is Wingham. This town is so frustrated and angry. Yeah, so are the people in Taree, but they get assistance. We get nothing out here.
That was Chris Smith, who is a resident here in Wingham. I've also been in the town's east today on one particular street that wasn't fully accessible till Monday. And here there's belongings and furniture still strewn outside people's houses. The lawns here are still completely muddy, but the residents say a lot of progress has been made. The mud on the street has been cleared away. I spoke to one man, Mario, who was living in the downstairs of his house, but he says everything there has been washed away, and he started tearing up talking about what he'd lost: his dogs, his chooks, his rabbits. He's had some volunteers come through while I've been here to drop off some food, some mattresses for him and his wife, and those volunteers have been doing drops to residents along this street, going back and forth from a local church where donations have been dropped off. But a lot of the residents here are still really shaken. Power isn't back on and none of these houses are livable. I've seen lots of electricians here, bobcats, excavators going up and down the street trying to do their work, but for the moment everyone here seems to just be doing what they can bit by bit to make things a bit more manageable.
Alison Shaw in Wingham, New South Wales. Well, in ever-increasing natural disasters, the acronym DRA is becoming more familiar to weary Australians dealing with loss and damage. Disaster Relief Australia is a veteran-led volunteer, not-for-profit, receiving federal funding to help prepare for and recover from natural disasters. In fact, there are more DRA volunteers on the ground in flood-affected New South Wales right now than defence personnel. David Smith is the CEO of Disaster Relief Australia. He joined me earlier. David, welcome to you.
Thanks very much, Andy. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
How are DRA assisting in the New South Wales flood cleanup?
So right at the moment, the State Emergency Service is still in control of what's occurring in the region, and we are working directly with the State Emergency Service to assist them with their efforts around early relief. And we'll continue to do that until such time as the response phase comes to an end, and then we move into recovery, and then we'll be working to the direction from the New South Wales Recovery Authority.
Your volunteers are largely veterans. What kinds of skills and backgrounds do they have? Who are they?
At the moment, around 60% of our volunteer base are either veterans or former or current first responders. And so what they bring is a range of skills from their service. The first is it's an attitude of service. So they really want to give back to communities in the way that they did when they were wearing the nation's uniform. They're also used to operating in difficult and uncertain and adverse environments. We can help with work order management, particularly for local government agencies, helping them to plan recovery. We do chainsaw operations and pole saw operations to remove fallen trees out of the way so that people can get access to properties and things of that like. We'll do debris removal and restoring access to residents and businesses. We also get involved in helping to manage what we call spontaneous volunteers. So local people who just want to come and help, and we can help with providing leadership to them and getting them onto tasks that meet the requirements of the controlling authority. We do some basic home repairs for people as well, and we can do logistics management and delivery as well to help get supplies into location.
Your organisation received $38 million in federal funding from the National Emergency Management Agency. How are you spending that money? And if your activities are expected to increase, are you seeking further funding from the federal government?
Yeah, look, we are enormously grateful to the Albanese government for the commitment they've made to us, the $38.3 million three-year commitment to us under what we've termed the Volunteer Uplift Program. So what that's doing is, firstly, since that program started, we've grown from a volunteer base of 2,500 to just over 5,700 now, with an aim of getting to 7,500 by the end of the grant in the middle of next year. But critically, what it's also allowed us to do is to build a backbone for the organisation that enables us to better support that growing volunteer base. So we now have established permanent staff in 10 disaster relief and recovery teams across the nation, so one in each capital city, plus one in North Queensland and one in northern New South Wales. And they do the direct engagement with our volunteers and direct engagement with stakeholders in the various jurisdictions. We've also established a National Operations Centre at Hendra in Brisbane. We've established equipment caches across the country to enable us to deploy more quickly. We've also significantly enhanced our training offering for our volunteers. So the Volunteer Outlet Program has been a game changer for us in terms of growing the organisation, and we're seeking to continue that past the end of the current grant period and are seeking additional government funding.
Do you see your organisation taking the heat out of ADF deployments for the Commonwealth Government in natural disasters?
Well, so what we seek to do is to be a viable alternative to the Australian Defence Force in disaster recovery operations. The reasoning behind that is pretty simple. We know that the Defence Strategic Review said that the Defence Force needs to focus its efforts as much as possible on its primary function, which of course is defending the nation's security. And I think the other critical thing I'd just like to highlight too is that we've been able, through our work, through an offering of continued service, through continued connection between veterans, to provide great support to the veteran community in Australia. And in fact, that's been borne out. We had a longitudinal study that looked at the impact of volunteering with DRA on the health and well-being of our volunteers, and it showed definitively that service with DRA by veterans has a very positive impact on their mental health and well-being. So there's a whole lot of things that we can do to assist in that space.
A win-win for sure. David Smith is the CEO of Disaster Relief Australia. Appreciate your time and efforts. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks very much, Andy. I appreciate your time too.
There's been more good news on the cost of living front today. Official data shows inflation rose 2.4% in the 12 months to April. For more, our business correspondent David Taylor joined me earlier. David, this is clearly showing price pressures are easing across the country, but are there any areas where the prices of goods or services are experiencing sharp increases?
Look, the largest contributors, Andy, to the annual movement were food and non-alcoholic beverages, up 3.1%, housing, up 2.2%, and I'll drill down into that a little further shortly, and recreation and culture, up 3.6%. That last category I gave you then, recreation and culture, it does show that Australians with a little bit of money in their pocket are choosing to have a little bit of fun, which is interesting. It shows the mood is there for people to spend on stuff that makes them happy. Look, in terms of the food and beverages category, fruit and veggies up 6.1%. That's quite a steep increase there. In the housing category, rents up 5%. That's easing from the last data set we had, but still anyone who's paying rent on a monthly basis or fortnightly basis would find that 5% difficult because, of course, it is higher than wages growth. Education, Andy, up 5.7%, and insurance up 4%. So the categories that we're watching out for, out-of-pocket healthcare costs, education, housing, and insurance, they're all still proving sticky, but crucially, Andy, they're not getting any worse in terms of the price increases.
July 8th, that's when the RBA meets again. Will the bank take any notice of these figures? And if so, do they support the case for more interest rate cuts?
I don't think they support the case for more interest rate cuts because you've got the trimmed mean data set in this particular release that we've had today. The trimmed mean actually rose from 2.7% to 2.8%. That figure is between the 2 and 3% inflation target that the Reserve Bank wants to achieve, and it strips out all the bumpy and volatile items of goods and services in the basket that the ABS measures. So it gives us a better picture of what the Reserve Bank is looking for, and even though it increased slightly, it is still in the band. That headline figure, that 2.4% figure, is stable. So look, Andy, on balance, the Reserve Bank will probably say this is okay. But let's hear from B2C's chief economist, David Bassanese.
Yeah, look, I think the market's probably getting ahead of itself, expecting the RBA to cut rates in July. I mean, the market prior to today's number had something like a 70% chance of a July rate cut. I thought the RBA was always going to wait till the quarterly CPI, which would have them cutting in August. So, I think today's number was not good enough to have them cut rates in July. So I think that's the key takeaway from today's monthly CPI report.
The fact that based on this data set, disinflation has stalled, is that a big story for you, or should we move on and take it as, well, this is a bumpy set of data?
But now the RBA is expecting trim mean inflation on an annual basis in the June quarter to come down to 2.6% from 2.9%. So today's numbers suggest that could be a bit of a stretch.
Economist David Bassanese there. So, David, the Australian dollar has been rising in value recently due to the weakness of the US dollar. Has this data set moved the local currency at all?
Andy, the Australian dollar fell noticeably on the back of the data set release, and it's probably suggesting that the financial markets, for one, see this data as not being an impediment to the Reserve Bank cutting interest rates again in July.
David Taylor. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. Overseas now, and he infamously said he'd end the war in one day. Now, 128 days later, President Donald Trump appears frustrated with Russia continuing to ignore requests to negotiate over the war in Ukraine. He accused Russian leader Vladimir Putin of playing with fire. The Kremlin has hit back, suggesting Donald Trump was at risk of triggering World War III. The exchange comes after Russia escalated its bombardment of Ukraine's cities, including the capital of Kyiv. Rachel Mealy reports.
President Trump's recent frustrations with Vladimir Putin are starting to boil over. In a social media post, he poured out his feelings to the Russian leader. What Vladimir Putin doesn't realise is that if it weren't for me, lots of really bad things would have already happened in Russia, and I mean really bad, he said, adding that he's playing with fire. That post prompted this response from Dmitry Medvedev, one of Vladimir Putin's Kremlin deputies, who typed it out in English.
I only know of one really bad thing, World War III. I hope Trump understands this.
The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov added to the onslaught, accusing Donald Trump of becoming emotional because his efforts for peace in Ukraine are being hamstrung by European leaders. He was referring to Friedrich Merz, the new Chancellor of Germany, who yesterday said that range restrictions had been lifted on the weapons Ukraine's allies are giving Ukraine to defend itself against Russian aggression. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Europe's leaders aren't speaking with a united voice.
This statement by Mr. Merz once again underlines the competence of the people now in power in Europe. Yesterday, he said that from now on, there will be no restrictions on the range of strikes. And he spoke for himself, for France, for Britain, and for the United States. Not long after, his vice chancellor said there was no talk of anything like that. No talk of anything like that.
The German Chancellor Friedrich Merz says he supports Ukraine being able to attack targets within Russian territory.
Wer nur einen Angriff auf dem eigenen Territorium abwehrt.
From my point of view, it's necessary because someone who can only repel an attack on their own territory can't adequately defend themselves. Only someone who's also able to attack military bases on the aggressor's territory can defend themselves.
Lieutenant General Ben Hodges is the former commanding general of US Army Europe. He says lifting range restrictions on weapons will allow Ukraine to get the upper hand.
The Ukrainians will have greater capability for striking Russian airfields and other places from which these terrible missile attacks have been taking place. So as General Breedlove said, it's better to kill the archer than try to knock down all the arrows. So this will give Ukraine better ability to strike the place from which these air and missile attacks are originating.
He says President Trump appears to be so frustrated seeking peace in Ukraine that he's walking away from it altogether.
Obviously, I wish I was completely wrong here. Not only is this bad for Ukrainians, it's terrible for American credibility. And the Chinese are watching this, that the administration seems to be flexible when it comes to sovereignty and international law and are looking for deals instead of defending all the things that we say are so important to us. So this is not a good situation for the United States and for our allies.
Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, the former commanding general of the US Army in Europe, ending that report by Rachel Mealy. Australia's first ever ban on the sale of machetes has taken effect as of midday. Victorian retailers spent the morning removing the bladed weapons from their shelves, but questions have been raised about how the ban will be enforced. Some retail managers say they've had little information from authorities, despite facing big fines or even jail time for selling banned machetes. Kimberly Price reports.
It's the first ban of its kind in Australia, sparked by a daytime machete brawl between rival gangs in a Melbourne shopping centre on Sunday. The Victorian government has today banned the sale of machetes across the state. Stephen is a manager of a camping shop in Melbourne.
I personally think it's a good idea. But there's other people that use it for, you know, purposes that aren't of a violent nature. And so it's affecting them being able to buy these items, machetes, just so that they can use it for, you know, clearing through shrubs, bushes, etc. that may be in the way when they're out camping or hunting.
The Victorian government broadly describes machetes as a cutting-edge knife with a blade of more than 20 centimetres. Stephen says his staff have been sorting through their products since the ban announcement on Monday.
We've just had to measure every blade that has been part of our core stock range, and anything that's been identified to be 20 centimetres or more, we've had to pull off the shelves and organise to be sent back to our main distribution warehouse.
How did you know to do this? Did you get a direction from the state government, or was it your own initiative seeing what was said in the news?
Bit of both, really. So essentially it was a directive that we had to look over and identify the ones that needed to come off that were going to be part of this ban.
The ban means retailers could face a fine of almost $50,000 or jail time if they continue to sell them. The owner of a hardware store in Melbourne, who wanted to remain anonymous, told The World Today she's in the dark about how it will work.
All we've been told is to take them off our shelves immediately. We don't know whether or not we will be reimbursed for the product we've already bought. Small businesses are doing it really tough at the moment.
Premier Jacinta Allen says her government has been in contact with retailers ahead of the ban coming in.
Back in March, when we brought in the tough new bylaws and Australia's first machete ban, we did say that we wanted to work with retailers from that point to stop placing orders. So there is an understood industry definition of what a machete is.
Today's ban on sales accompanies a ban on the possession of the weapon and a machete amnesty beginning in September. Minister of Consumer Affairs Nick Stakos says the government has released six photos to help shop owners identify what machetes are banned.
Retailers must remove machetes from sale and store them in a safe, secure place until such time as the amnesty commences.
The state opposition says Victoria cannot wait until September for a full ban on machetes. David Southwick is the Shadow Minister for Police.
Firstly, it's too little too late. The opposition's been calling on a ban now for 18 months. We've had four attempts to actually have a ban on these machetes. The government's now scrambling to get this thing done, but it's only half-baked.
The Victorian Liberal National Party is introducing a private bill for a full ban on machetes. Dr. Samara McFedrin is a senior research fellow with the Violence Research and Prevention Program at Griffith University. She doesn't believe a ban on a single weapon will make a difference.
It's unrealistic to expect that banning one particular weapon will have any serious impact on violence. Unfortunately, making these types of decisions doesn't actually address the root causes of violence.
Victoria Police have made a seventh arrest in relation to Sunday's machete gang brawl.
Kimberly Price and Kathleen O'Connor reporting. Well, yesterday you might have heard how Australia's second largest private hospital operator has gone into receivership, while other operators say they're also struggling. Private hospitals account for about 40% of all hospital admissions here in Australia, and the latest data shows demand for care is on the rise, as Annie Guest reports.
Whether it's surgery or medical care, the Institute of Health and Welfare's spokesperson Clara Jelly says there's a clear trend.
Our latest data on hospitals in Australia has shown us that the rate and the number of hospitalisations in public and private hospitals has increased over the past decade.
Clara Jelly says a decade ago there were 405 admissions to hospital for every 1,000 of us. Now that's risen to 421.
In fact, we're seeing that hospitalisation rates are increasing over and above the ageing population.
For decades, health officials have emphasised that as health care improves, we need to go to hospital less for our treatment. But this data suggests we're going in the opposite direction.
Yes, well, certainly the data that we have does show that people are using hospitals more and more.
The Public Health Association's CEO, Terry Slevin, says the increase in hospital admissions echoes the rise in chronic illness, such as heart disease, cancer and diabetes.
In 2007-08, 42% of all people in Australia had at least one chronic condition. In the last few years, that's now gone to 50% and probably above. So there's a clear trend of chronic conditions having a major impact on the health of all Australians.
Being overweight or obese increases your risk of developing a chronic illness, and two-thirds of adults are now an unhealthy weight. Terry Slevin explains why.
The frequency with which we're driving past unhealthy food, junk food products in our suburbs, the extent to which we're not getting the kind of physical activity that has helped balance that energy intake and consumption that keeps us a healthy weight. The extent to which we're being promoted so much of the stuff that's not so good for us, and we hear very little about the stuff that is good for us.
Health reform is one of five areas the federal government has asked the Productivity Commission to examine. Terry Slevin wants a greater focus on prevention.
investing a modest amount of resources, $1.20 of our health dollars, into making us healthier rather than just focusing on treating us when we're crook. Forestalling cardiovascular diseases, cancers, dementia, some of those musculoskeletal challenges means we can be more productive for longer. And the better part of all of that is we can have a better life.
Terry Slevin from the Public Health Association ending Annie Guest's report. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump is beginning to make a habit of it, confronting world leaders while the cameras are rolling in the Oval Office. His latest victim, South Africa's president, who was ambushed with Trump's claims that white farmers are being persecuted in his country. Today, Nancy Jacobs, a professor of history at Brown University, on why Trump is so keen to spread false assertions of genocide. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.